was big, polluted, and crowded. If Amy had once daydreamed about meeting her birth mother, she now understood it would be impossible to find her. One woman out of the proverbial 1.3 billion people. Finally, they flew to Kunming in Yunnan, where it was much cooler. They stayed at another fancy hotel, which prompted Adam to ask Alice, "Can you believe how much everything's changed since the last time we were here? You've got to hand it to Deng Xiaoping. To get rich is glorious." When they were out with their new guide, Amy heard sounds that were vaguely familiar yet had no meaning. She saw people with skin like hers, darker, who turned out to be members of hill tribes. Sometimes people nodded to her on the street or pointed at her, but what did that mean? Did they recognize her in some way, or did they simply think she looked peculiar with her white parents? A couple of times people came up to her and spoke to her in Chinese. "I don't speak Chinese," Amy always answered in English. Then those same people would turn to her parents and ask, in perfect English, "Is she your tour guide?" But how could Amy have possibly been their tour guide? The Bowens spent the next 2 days hiking up mountains to take in this or that scenic spot. Amy's opinion? One view was just like another, even if these had a temple or a big statue on them. Still, something about the air and the panoramas got to her. Like she had something in her eye or pollen up her nose or a memory she could sense but couldn't capture. Then one day, during one of their sightseeing hikes, she was standing and looking at yet another view. The pattern of the hills, a stream running through them, a path winding up through the terraces. "Mom, look!"
"What is it, honey?"
"Do you see it?" she pointed, buzzing with excitement. "It's just like my tea cake."
"What do you mean?" Alice asked.
"We've always looked at the V's as V's, like simple bird drawings, but don't you see? They're the canyons between the mountains. The wavy lines are terraces. The design that meanders," she traced what she could remember from the tea cake in the air with her index finger, "is a river or creek or something like that. The design on my tea cake is a map."
"Oh my God," Adam exclaimed.
"You're right." But Alice, ever practical, asked, "But a map to what?" "To where I was born." Amy was so energized by her discovery that she was practically jumping up and down. "So I can meet my birth family." Adam and Alice exchanged glances. Amy thought, "Don't ruin this for me."
Her father looped an arm over her shoulder, pulled her close, and stared at the view with her.
"It is a map, and it's amazing you figured that out. Truly amazing. But honey, remember how there's that design in the middle of the tea cake?" Amy interrupted. "I've always thought it looked like a tree, but it's gotta be my real mom."
Alice edged away.
"Your mom is your real mom," Adam said softly. "I didn't mean it that way." Amy didn't either. "But think about it. X marks the spot. It's gotta be her."
"Maybe you're right." He still had that gentle tone, trying to manage his wife, who was all upset that Amy didn't consider Alice to be her real mother, and his daughter, who was as excited as she'd ever been. "But with any map, you need a starting point. The V's, the canyons and mountains could be anywhere. We don't even know which direction is north." What felt like a bomb going off obliterated Amy's elation. Her father was right, and it was a huge disappointment. But then she realized, "I always thought my birth mom was trying to send me a message. I was right." Goosebumps rippled along her arms.
"I'm sorry, honey," Alice said, extending her hand.
Amy took it because she didn't want to hurt her mother's feelings any more than she already had when what she felt inside was a buoyant thrill. Her birth mom was real to her in a way she'd never been before. That night, Amy dreamed about her birth mother and the map. In the morning, she tiptoed into the adjoining room and stood at the foot of the bed, waiting for one of her parents to wake up. Alice's eyes flickered open first, and she startled when she saw her daughter staring down at her.
"What is it? Are you okay?"
"My real mom, I mean, my birth mom, wants me to find her." Adam blinked awake. "What's going on?"
"Let's put up a flyer," Amy announced, "like for a lost dog."
Where would you put it? Alice asked, doubtful. On telephone poles and restaurants, like what people do at home, please? What do you think, Adam? Alice asked. He sat all the way up and propped some pillows behind his back. He had the same grave look on his face as he'd had yesterday when he told Amy she needed a starting point for the map. We picked you up in Kunming, but you aren't from here, he said. You were brought from another orphanage. I know, but what if she's visiting? Amy wasn't going to let this go. We're visiting. What if she's visiting, too? What if she moved here? What if she's outside right this minute? What if? Alice echoed, shaking her head sadly. Please, Amy begged. If we do this, we don't want you to have false hope, Adam said. We don't want you to be disappointed, Alice added. You have to consider the odds. Amy went back to her room, opened her laptop, and signed in to the hotel's internet service. Numbers came easily to her, so she expected to find a quick set of figures to noodle with. Except true numbers didn't exist. The first 61 adoptees came to the U.S. in 1991. That number continued to rise, to close to 63,000 between 1991 and 2005. After that, the stats were harder to find, with a steady decline in adoptions from China. But if there were something like 100,000 Chinese adoptees and approximately 650 million females in China, then Amy had a 1 in 6,500 chance in finding her mother. The chances got a lot better if you considered only women in their childbearing years. If the numbers on the internet are accurate, Alice said after Amy presented her findings. Amy pulled up a story she'd once found and bookmarked on the laptop screen. Look at this, Mom. Here's an article about someone who found her mother. It says here that 20 families have been reunited. How? Alice asked as her husband picked up the laptop and began reading. She was on a trip like this with her parents. They were walking down the street when a total stranger came up and said, "You look like my sister's daughter." And guess what? That woman turned out to be the girl's aunt. That's a 1 in a million occurrence. Amy leaned over her dad, hit a few keys, and pulled up a different story. Then what about this one? Another family was on a trip just like ours. Her family made a flyer to post. The first place they went in was a cafe. They asked if they could hang the flyer. The couple who ran the cafe looked at the flyer and burst into tears. It was their daughter. Now the two families spend every Christmas together. Those sound like made-up stories, Alice said. There's all sorts of nonsense on the internet. Adam looked up from the laptop. Actually, honey, what Amy's telling you is from an article in the Boston Globe. The first one was in the New York Times. But what are the odds? Alice asked, repeating her earlier concern. I don't want Amy to be disappointed. I promise not to be disappointed, Amy said. Mom's right, you know, Adam said. Please, Dad, please, Amy pled, turning all her focus on her father, because he rarely said no to her. Will you let me do it? Please? But Alice gave in first. There's no harm in trying. Get some paper from the desk. Let's figure out what you want to say. They spent the next hour working together, narrowing down the details and keeping the English simple. My name is Amy Bowen. I was born on or about November 24th, 1995. I am looking for my biological family. I was found in a cardboard box. I was wrapped in a blue blanket. There was a cake of tea in the box with me. I am short. My skin is dark compared to most Chinese. In case you want to know more about me, I am good at science and math. I like to ski and ride horses. I also like to hang out with friends. I am very nice. I hope you would like to meet me. To contact me, please email my father at abowen@abarbor.com. After breakfast, they went to the business center. They hadn't brought the photo of Amy taken when she was first found or any of those that Alice and Adam took the day they got her. All they had was the fourth grade school picture from Alice's wallet and Amy's current passport photo. She positioned them on the piece of paper with the note and pushed the button to make copies. Then they walked around the neighborhood where they were staying and tacked up the notices. By the time they were done, Amy knew that nothing would come of her plan. Maybe her birth mother didn't read English. Maybe she didn't have a computer to send an email. Maybe she didn't know what a computer or email were. And so many people live there. What kind of coincidence could there be in the world for Amy's birth mother to be walking down this particular street, see a picture of Amy in her school uniform, and think, "Oh, there's my baby." Amy was very disappointed, and she felt herself spiraling into sadness. Her mom and dad worried about her because she had a history of anxiety and depression. Her dad tried to distract her with jokes. Her mom offered to take her shopping for souvenirs to give to her friends. But Amy had a serious case of the blues. On the last night of the trip, Alice knocked on the door that connected the two rooms. "May I come in?" she asked, opening the door a couple of inches. "Sure, Mom." Alice sat on Amy's bed. "I'm sorry this didn't work out. I'm sorry we brought you here. Don't worry about it." "Oh, honey, I wish I could make you understand." The way Alice's voice trailed off forced Amy to ask. "Understand what?" "How your dad and I felt when we got you. What you meant to us then. What you mean to us now. In the months leading up to the phone call that told us we could come and get you, I did everything I could to understand Chinese culture. I went on a walking tour of Chinatown. I devoured Amy Tan's books. I watched Chinese movies. And we had all the practical stuff to do, too. Our finances were critiqued and notarized. We were interviewed and authenticated. We traveled with 6 other family units. 3 couples were married, 2 were gay, and there was a single woman with her mom." "The way you cried." "I've seen the photo album," Amy said. "In those pictures, you could see the family unit people weeping and laughing. All the babies were crying, too, but her mouth had been a giant, gaping hole. Her eyes were squished shut. Her legs and arms, her whole body, actually, were as stiff as a board, and her cheeks were bright red because she was screaming her head off. I cried, and I didn't sleep." "The other babies cried, but you howled," Alice agreed. "You howled, and you wouldn't sleep. I'm sure you understand the objective cause and effect reasons for that." "Objective cause and effect reasons? Can you for once speak to me from your heart and not like a scientist?" "I'm trying," Alice sighed. "I know I can be frustrating sometimes, but I only want the very, very, very best for you. I wish for you to feel smart and invincible." To Amy's ears, her mother's wishes sounded more like pressure to do more and achieve more, but she didn't say that. "You see," Alice continued, "your crying was only natural. You were older than the other babies. You'd never seen a white person before. We don't think you'd been picked up or held very much. You needed a lot of love. We gave you the love and you stopped crying, but honey sweet, we're still waiting for you to sleep."
"Ha, ha, ha, and blah, blah, blah."
"I know, stupid humor. I'm sorry. Would you please stop saying you're sorry? What I'm trying to tell you is that I've always wondered if you were crying because you missed your birth mother. I've thought about her every day since we got you. I couldn't have a baby myself, so I wondered if she was afraid when you were born. Was she in a hospital? Was she alone? Was your birth father at her side?" "I've wondered the same things, too," Amy admitted. "Not a day has gone by when I haven't wondered if I hurt you more than helped you by wresting you away from your homeland and your culture. Even when you were a baby, I wondered when you would start to resent me for that. Maybe even hate me." "I don't hate you, Mom." "The first night your dad and I had you, we piled pillows on the extra double bed in our room to make a protective nest for you. Your dad fell asleep, but I stayed awake all night. I wept when you grabbed my finger and held it tight. Your birth mother gave me the greatest gift of my life, a beautiful, talented, and kind daughter. Every day I take a moment to thank her for that. Your first smile, your first tooth, your first day of preschool, your first everything, I thought of her and thanked her. And she is with you always. Your birth father, too. They're in your tears. They're in your laugh. They're in you in ways you will never be able to count. And their love is what sent you to me. Tears began to well in Alice's eyes, and Amy felt herself being swept into her mother's ocean of love. From the first moment I saw you all the way to today, and for as long as I live, I know that you are the daughter who was meant for me. I can never be a replacement for your birth mother, but I've done and will continue to do everything I can to complete what should have been her journey. I love you, and I'll always love you. Amy held on to those words like they were a lifesaver.
Evaluation. Haley, while you completely ignored my admonition not to write about the immigrant experience, I congratulate you for coming at it from a unique angle. There's much you can work with here as you begin to think about your college app, but bear in mind that there will be other young women across the country who may write similar essays about their own adoption experiences. A few nitpicking points. Amy, Alice, and Adam feels a bit cloying to me. Do they really all need to start with an A? Watch your language usage and remember that a thesaurus isn't always your friend. And of course, you'd never want to use bazillion or ginormous on a college app, but I'm sure you know that. I'm quite conflicted about the ending. As your teacher, I would have hated to see you fall back on the Shakespearean trope of coincidence. As a mom, I really wanted your main character to find her birth mother. For a math science girl, you did an excellent job. Now take the nonfiction elements and run with them, making sure you keep the emotional resonance of your fictional narrative.
Cherry blossoms in spring.
Amma! Amma!
My son's screams pull Jin and me out of sleep. It's all right, I say, patting my husband's arm. I'll go. I pad barefoot down the darkened hallway to Paul's room, where he sits up in his bed, shaking, his hands clutching his duvet, tears streaming down his face. Dr. Katz, our pediatrician, calls what Paul gets night terrors. They've worsened the past 2 weeks, which the doctor says is completely normal.
Usually children are scared when they start first grade. They're with all the big kids now, but in second grade, a lot of kids are scared about space aliens. Maybe that's what's happening here.
The Ruma, Nima, and Ama would see things differently. They'd say Jinba is being stalked by bad spirits. Deja has taken precautions, but stringing ivy around his room hasn't seemed to help. In fact, it may have made things worse. Because the kids who've come over on playdates see it as two, whether they're white or Han majority. Paul, look at me, I say gently as I sit on the edge of the bed. Do you see me? The saddest thing about his night terrors is that he's not asleep, but he's not awake either. He looks at me, but sees something beyond or through me. His eyes are wide. He trembles. He screams again.
Amma!
I hold my hands out to him and rub my thumbs against the tips of my fingers in the traditional Akka gesture to bring him to me. He climbs onto my lap, but I won't know he's fully conscious until he calls me Mom. Rarely is he lucid enough to tell me what his dreams are about, apart from monsters. Tonight, though, he tells me a little of what he remembers.
I got lost in the forest. The trees looked cracked and broken. I didn't hear any birds. It was quiet and hot. So much sweat was running down my legs, I thought I'd peed my pants.
I tighten my arms around him. He's had a few bedwetting episodes lately. If he'd been raised in spring well, the liquid would have just spilled down between the slats of the bamboo floor. Here, Dr. Katz calls it
something we need to be concerned about.
Then the rains came,
Paul sputters.
Monsoon, like you've told me about. I felt like I was drowning. Drowning in the forest is a terrible death. Isn't that what you said, Mom?
Mom, good. You aren't going to drown in a monsoon. You live in Arcadia. We are in a drought.
But, Mom!
Shh! Close your eyes. I'm right here. I hum to him until I feel his breath deepen. I don't need Ama to help me interpret my son's dream. He's scared about school. I understand that. But he's also picked up on some of my anxieties. I need to be more careful when I'm talking on the phone to my brothers. And I need to be extra vigilant in my conversations with Jin. Over the last couple of years, the dry seasons in the Tea Mountains have lasted longer, while the monsoons have become more intense. Our tea leaf bud sets are bursting early, and the 10-day picking season has been prolonged. Worse, the new weather pattern is stunting growth, just as Paul saw in his dream. I can taste the change in the leaves, but I'm not a scientist and I don't know what it means. Still, I worry, and that worry has invaded my son's sleeping hours. Nothing is worse than seeing your child suffer. Every morning I ask about his dreams. Did a tree fall? Was there a fire? A dog on a roof? Or a broken egg? Instead of these questions calming him and helping him understand his place in the world, he's become even more scared and his dreams more tormented. I feel terrible about it, and honestly, don't know what to do. I slip out of bed at sunrise, heat water for tea, and roll rice balls in crushed peanuts for Paul's lunch. Jin wanders in, kisses me, sits down, and opens the paper.
May I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich instead?
Paul begs when he comes into the kitchen and sees what I've prepared.
Just today. Just this once.
As if I would ever do such a thing. Into my silence, he says, Auntie Deja would make one for me. Deja would, too. She spoils him to the extreme. But she's in Yunnan for a month visiting her natal family, as she now does every year.
Mom,
my son persists,
why is what I want different than a ball of rice with peanuts on the outside? White outside, brown inside? Brown outside, white inside. Same thing.
Is that what the Han majority children eat? I ask, because if they aren't eating Chinese food in school, maybe Paul shouldn't either.
Oh, Mom, everyone brings Chinese food from home.
Then...
Addison likes peanut butter and jelly.
Addison. I taste the three syllables on my tongue. I glance at Jin, who looks up from his copy of the Chinese Daily News. Addison. What kind of name is that? I drive carpool in the mornings, so Paul and I pick up two other kids on the way to school. Music plays on the radio. The kids sing along. I pull up to the curb for the carpool drop-offs and hit the button to unlock their doors. Paul's the last to get out. He lingers by the door as he puts on his backpack. Is this Addison white or Han majority? I ask. But he just waves, slams the door, and runs to a group of boys I recognize. All born here. All Han majority. I can't stay to watch him enter the building. Too many cars and minivans behind me, but I feel a tug on my heart. We may not have strings tied around our wrists any longer, but I will always be connected to my son. Driving home, I have time to reflect. I'm 37, in the summer of my life. My husband is successful. He's kept his cardboard business, but that's not his real focus these days. During the darkest days of the recession, when stocks kept tumbling and real estate prices crashed, he began buying houses at the bottom of the market, which he fixed up and sold to men like himself who wanted a foothold in America and a safe place to park their money. When our son turned 5, Jin underwent yet another transformation. He was finally able to put away the ghost of his father.
Paul is the same age I was when I betrayed my father, he told me. I now understand that he would have loved me, no matter what I'd done, as I'll always love my son.
With the burdens of a lifetime lifted from Jin's shoulders, he started building housing tracts in Walnut, Riverside, Irvine, and Las Vegas for Han-majority people, featuring wok kitchens and following feng shui construction practices. Still not content, he opened real estate offices in the lobbies of the Hilton and the Crown Plaza, the top San Gabriel Valley hotels for Chinese tourists, and hired jumper consultants to provide information on mortgages and schools, help people through the U.S. EB-5 visa process, and sell properties ranging from modest houses for speculation to luxurious mansions starting at $10 million for sons and daughters attending USC or Occidental. I found success as well. Since 2008, the price for good tea has steadily risen. Then this year, boom! Poor's value skyrocketed again. My company is large, with offices in the San Gabriel Valley and Guangzhou. We sell raw, processed, and aged pu'er from inexpensive to extremely rare and expensive blends that are given as gifts to the most powerful leaders in China. I have plenty of capital, and I do my own sourcing. I have arrangements with nearly every village on Nanduo Mountain. Farmers come to me each year, hearing I pay fairly and reliably, to tell me they've discovered ancient tea trees or abandoned tea gardens high, high up on the mountain. I tell them their tea must come from trees at least 300 years old. And the farmers themselves need to drink from the leaves first to make sure the trees aren't so wild that they'll make people ill. My three brothers check every batch, and if a farmer ever attempts to sneak poor quality leaves into what he sells me, we'll never do business again. I even have a fermenting factory in Menghai. The main room is as large as an American football field. Piles of tea, each 12 by 30 feet and a foot deep, cover the entire floor, each weighing 5 tons and each at a different stage of fermentation. The whole complex is surrounded by a high wall topped with barbed wire. I receive many requests for tours from international connoisseurs, dealers, and scientists. I turn them all away, saying, "If you want to learn about our ancient tea trees, come to Nanuo Mountain." Every tea I make is artisanal. No pesticides, no mechanization. All that can carry on without my presence, except for tea picking season when Paul and I return to the mountains to supervise picking, processing, and fermenting because I have the help and trust of my family. My three nieces, who were all born in the same year, are now 19 years old. The government has a message for them. Your duty to the nation is to have a child of high quality. But not one of them has married. They dismiss those busybodies who tell them that soon they'll be as yellowed pearls, too old to be fully loved. They still have 8 years before they're officially labeled Shengyu, leftover women. So they laugh at the television shows that show women desperately trying to get a man at any cost. The price of being a Shengyu. Go, go, Shengyu! And even Shengyu get crazy. They tease each other about the 12 products to help Shengyu forget about loneliness and give those items as birthday gifts to keep the joke going. A garlic peeler, rainbow-colored linens, and single-serving teapots. First sister-in-law's daughter works for me in my shop in the Fengcheng Tea Market. Second sister-in-law's daughter has remained in the village, but travels all through the mountains on her motorcycle to make sure the farmers who sell to us are picking the very best leaves. Third sister-in-law's daughter lives in the San Gabriel Valley and handles my internet sales. When and if my nieces decide they want to go work eat with a husband, they'll have plenty of men to choose from, for there are 30 million more young males seeking mates in China than there are prospective brides. But how to convince them?
I do what I want to do, first sister-in-law's daughter told me the last time I saw her. I go where I want to go.
Be that as it may, I know for a fact that my mother-in-law now sits on her bench in Martyrs Memorial Garden when she's in Guangzhou or wanders San Gabriel Square, what we sometimes laughingly call the Great Mall of China, when she's visiting us to look for eligible, wealthy and handsome, husbands for my nieces. Let them try to get out of that. Cité and I still avoid each other, but I hear a lot about her, as I'm sure she hears about me. She's converted much of the land she subleased to coffee, as she vowed she would 7 years ago. Yunnan has even become a tourist attraction for Han-majority coffee enthusiasts. And it's said that by the end of the year, more than 1 million people in our province will be working in the coffee industry, since we provide over 95% of China's coffee production. As an added benefit, growing coffee has become a way for our government and those of our neighbors, like Laos, to replace opium poppy crops. Cité sells Yunnan coffee to Starbucks for use in its Asian outlets and helped Nestle found a coffee institute in Poor City, while I acted as the go-between who assisted the town of Libourne in France, home of the Pomerol and Saint-Emilion vineyards, in signing a marketing and trade agreement with Poor City to cross-promote their wines and our tea because both share polyphenols, which are reported to be so good for health. I pull into the garage and find a note from Jin saying that he won't be home until late afternoon. Sitting at the kitchen counter, I open my laptop and scan through my emails, looking for one in particular. During my last trip from the airport in Jinghong to Menghai, I saw among the many billboards that now line the roadway one that had been purchased by an individual family. It showed an infant's face blown up so big it was blurry. The type, however, was completely clear. I was found outside the post office in Jinghong on May 21, 1994. My American name is Bethany Price. If you are my mother, please contact me. The birth date and clothes were wrong, and even as a newborn, she looked more Dai than Aka to me. But seeing the billboard inspired me to send an email to the girl. Could this Bethany have passed through the Social Welfare Institute in Kunming as my daughter did? Might her parents have met the parents of my Yanye? Does Bethany know other girls adopted from Shishuangbanna Prefecture? Today, again, no return message. Nor do I have any inquiries from the messages I left on various websites. A year ago, after finding posts written by adopted girls looking for their mothers, or more infrequently, mothers like me looking for their daughters, I wrote on my own, Yunnan birth mother, searching for daughter left at Menghai Social Welfare Institute. She was given to new parents by Kunming Social Welfare Institute. My baby was born on November 24, 1995, in the Western calendar. I named her Yan Ye. I put her in a box. She was found by street cleaners. I hid to make sure they delivered her to safety. I now have a 7-year-old son. I would love to find my missing daughter. You have a brother and a mother who love you very much. I didn't mention the tea cake. In a murder investigation, as I've learned from watching American television shows, you always hold out the most important evidence. Would someone take the bait? But the few emails I've received ask the same basic question. Are you my mother? I respond with, Were you found with anything in your swaddling? We are trying to grasp fish with our bare hands. I've never forgotten what Ama said to me before I left Nanuo Mountain to give birth to my son. She wanted me to have him in America in hopes that my daughter might intuit she had a brother. I know Yan Ye is out there. I have the photo and footprint from the Social Welfare Institute. I'll forever be grateful that she was cared for by the good matrons there, and not a baby who was stolen or confiscated from her parents. Even the Chinese government estimates that between 30,000 and 60,000 children go missing each year to be trafficked illegally and exported like so many factory products. I ache for the mothers in China and the mothers here who must always wonder. Nevertheless, shouldn't there be more clues and traces of Yan Ye? So, I search the internet when Jin is in meetings, at night when I can't sleep, and on Wednesday afternoons during Paul's soccer practice. I've stumbled across several sites advertising orphanage reunion tours, where girls and their families can see the cribs they slept in and meet the people who once watched over them. Could my daughter have gone to China with our Chinese Daughters Foundation or Roots and Shoots Heritage Tours? Even if she did, would a tour operator take a girl and her family to a town as small as Menghai? Wouldn't they show people like Mai Yan Ye, the larger social welfare institute in Kunming where she was picked up? Mightn't she or her parents want to look at her file? But all the files were destroyed in the fire. Still, once a week, I go to the tour website and examine the photos of white parents or single white mothers traveling with their Chinese daughters. The girls seem totally American with their flip-flops, shorts, and Hello Kitty t-shirts. Would Yan Ye look like me? Like Sanpa? Like my ama or his ama? But I haven't seen a girl with Aka characteristics or who resembles anyone of our blood. On a Facebook page, sponsored by an international group of Chinese adoptees, I saw photos of babies from the day they were found and the day they were delivered to their new parents. One infant was dressed in a dirty snowsuit with a purple knit hat. Her cheeks were chafed with heat rash. Another, sound asleep, wore a blouse with a flouncy polka dot collar. Yet another, perhaps 18 months old, wore a diaper that hung down to her striped knee socks, which in turn ended in red plastic sandals. I found photos of babies in ethnic minority caps, hats, and scarves, but none of them showed Aka handiwork. My heart filled with hope the day I discovered a website looking for DNA material to match mothers with daughters. I sent in mine, but never got a response. I've gone to the Los Angeles chapter of Families with Children from China to teach a cultural class about tea. The group, I've been told, is a shadow of its former self. The people who now run things, all volunteers, are new. Plus, apparently, they never kept great records to begin with. I've also developed tea tasting programs at the Huntington Library for adults and kids. And on the weekends, I visit garage sales to look for old tea cakes, because what if my daughter or her parents decided the tea cake I left with her wasn't worth keeping? None of these activities has yet brought me luck. I check my watch. It's 10 o'clock and business email is arriving, but I decide to scan the human interest articles first. In China and America, in newspapers, and on a few blogs I've come to admire and trust, to look for pieces about adopted Chinese girls who found their mothers or parents or siblings. These stories keep me optimistic and make me wonder if my daughter is searching for me, too. If my daughter were ever to post an inquiry, where would she do it? If my daughter were ever to buy a billboard, where would it be? If my daughter were ever to try to learn about her tea cake, where would she take it? It's said that great sorrow is no more than a reflection of one's capacity for great joy. I see it from the opposite direction. I'm happy, but there's an empty space inside me that will never stop suffering from the loss of Yanye. After all these years, it's a companion rather like the friend living with child. It's nourished me and forced me to breathe when it would have been so easy to give up. Suffering has brought clarity into my life. Maybe the things that have happened to me are punishment for what I did in a previous life. Maybe they were fate or destiny. And maybe they're all just part of a natural cycle, like the short but spectacular lives of cherry blossoms in spring or leaves falling away in autumn. I will never give up searching for Yanye. But now, at 11 o'clock, I force myself to move on to business.
Email between Haley Davis and Professor Annabeth Ho regarding Stanford senior thesis, first week of October 2015. Professor Ho, I so appreciate your agreeing to be my advisor next year for my senior thesis. When I visited during your office hours last week, you asked to see a draft of my research proposal. This is the first pass. The Impact of Climate Change on Sensory and Medicinal Attributes of Tea. Camellia sinensis, grown from tea trees in the tropical regions of China. This thesis will have two areas of study. 1. How are compounds that create the taste, smell, and look of tea, a combination of amino acids, catechins, theobromine, methylxanthine, and free sugars, being influenced by global climate change? 2. High levels of biodiversity in the tropical forest lead to a rich food chain, which helps to minimize insect and parasite infestations. Specifically, the compounds previously listed make up defensive agents against pathogens, predators, and oxidative stress that have arisen among tea trees growing in their biodiverse and increasingly threatened habitat. In numerous studies, these natural protections have also been shown to be beneficial to Homo sapiens. Of these, catechins, a group of polyphenolic flavin-3-ol monomers and their gallate derivatives, are considered to be the primary health-giving compounds in tea. The most important of these is EGCG, which is the most bioactive and which has entered the domain of well-being culture. With the intensified monsoons brought about by climate change, many of these antioxidant compounds are decreasing by as much as 50%, while other compounds are increasing. Therefore,
How are tea trees' natural protections being affected by global climate change, and what will the consequences be on the health benefits of the tea leaf? Materials and methods include farmer surveys, interviews, and the gathering and testing of tea leaves. Thank you for your time, and I hope to hear your thoughts at your earliest convenience. Haley Davis.
Haley, this looks very ambitious, but what else can I expect from a student with two majors, biology and earth sciences? You must be aiming not just to graduate with honors, as all those who choose to write a senior thesis will achieve, or even to graduate with distinction, assuming your GPA is high enough, which I'm sure it will be, but with the Firestone Award for Social and Natural Science. Before we get into the meat of your thesis, I have a few practical questions. 1. I'd like to know your personal interest in such an arcane subject. Don't get me wrong, the winners of the Firestone Award seem to specialize in arcana, which the committee appreciates. It will behoove you to flesh out that aspect. 2. I assume you plan to go to Yunnan. Are you applying for a fellowship or some other type of funding? Would you consider an internship with a larger academic study already underway? My concern is how you'll get to these farms, where you'll stay, and how you'll communicate. On behalf of the university, I can say we don't want you to do anything that will put you in danger or outside your comfort zone. 3. This looks like a multi-year study. Do you plan to carry on with your research in graduate school? 4. Regarding the health benefits to which you refer, we know that green tea has high levels of polyphenols. These antioxidants fight free radicals, which many scientists believe contribute to the aging process, including damage to DNA, some types of cancer, cardiovascular disease, etc. But apart from the University of Maryland Medical Center's study, can you point to proven health claims? I'm not interested in marketing anecdotal evidence or supposition about tea that isn't backed by fact or reason. I want to see legitimate documentation on this before you move forward. 5. I presume one reason you approached me to be your advisor is that I'm Chinese. As such, I hope you'll consider adding a third area to your thesis, even though it's not within the hard science realm. How do we reconcile the poetry and philosophy of tea with the practicalities of growing and processing the product? I grew up hearing ancient beliefs about tea from my immigrant parents. Every hour spent drinking tea is a distillation of all the tea hours that have ever been spent, and truly you can find the universal through the particular of tea. Personally, I see a real disconnect between a sentiment like, tea is the cup of humanity, and the hardscrabble life of tea farmers. If you can incorporate these humanistic aspects in your materials and methods, I believe the awards committee will take notice and your thesis will rise above others. I hope I haven't overwhelmed you. Professor Annabeth Ho.
Professor Ho, thank you for your thoughtful and thought-provoking questions. I realize now I should have given you a little more background. Let me try to do that, as well as answer your queries. Last summer, I went to the World Tea Expo, which happened to be in Southern California, where I'm from. I sampled teas from Thailand, Vietnam, India, Sri Lanka, Ghana, Uganda, seemingly everywhere. A whole section of the expo was devoted to the teas of Yunnan, especially Pu'er, which is extremely rare in China and even rarer in the world. People at the expo were gambling that tea will be the next big thing here in the United States, where sales of loose, bagged, and ready-to-drink teas have steadily risen over the last 2 decades. This year, the estimated wholesale value of the U.S. tea industry is $11.5 billion. The clincher, it seems to me, is Starbucks' purchase of Teavana in 2012. It also doesn't take a genius to notice the similarities between tea and wine connoisseurs. They both talk about vintage, harvest seasons, varietals, geographic source, the effects of light, soil, weather, and, of course, age on taste. Even the language to describe flavor is similar. Acidic, followed by notes of orchid and plum. At the expo, I also met a whole set of people I never expected to see, scientists and doctors. Yunnan is known as a global biodiversity hotspot. The province is said to have as much flowering plant diversity as the rest of the Northern Hemisphere combined, which gives it a lushness found nowhere else in the world. The province makes up only 4% of China's landmass, yet it's home to more than half its mammal and bird species, as well as 25 of China's 55 ethnic minorities. All this got me thinking about global warming and its effect on the quality and intensity of light, which in turn will change the final product, whether wine or tea. Plants with medicinal qualities are coming out of the Amazon rainforest. Couldn't something come out of the tropical forest of Yunnan? And just as in the Amazon, the tea mountains of Yunnan are being encroached on by development and pollution, particularly air pollution, which I know is of particular interest to you. Lastly, at the fair I met a man named Sean Wong. I showed him a tea cake that I have. He encouraged me to take it, what he called an ideal specimen, to the place of origin, as so many connoisseurs and collectors do. This was not the first time someone has suggested this to me. He said I could travel with him. I'm jumping at the opportunity. I hope that's a help. Haley.
Haley, I need you to dig deeper and answer my very specific questions. I'm here to challenge you. I hope you understand that. And please don't take this the wrong way, but I also need to inquire about your relationship with the person who invited you to travel with him. What do you know about him? Is he actually going to help you with your research? What is his motive to take a young woman to such a remote area? I'm sure you understand where I'm going with this, and it makes me very uncomfortable even to bring it up. You have a promising academic career ahead of you. With that comes great opportunities and responsibilities. I suspect you'll be offended when you read this, but if I ultimately agree to be your advisor, I have a duty to know you'll be safe, on behalf of your parents, the university, and my own peace of mind. Professor Annabeth Ho.
Professor Ho, to answer your questions, 1, my interest in this subject is very much tied to my upbringing. My father is an arborist. As a child, I rode along as he worked, managing orchards and visiting sick trees. He showed me how to mix compounds to feed or spray them for different needs. He once told me, "You're learning at my side." And I was, because I listened to every word he said and I absorbed them into my body like the trees absorb their medicines and nutrients. Thanks to my father, I've had a front row seat to observe the devastating effects of California's drought on our trees, which, in their weakened state, have been preyed upon by pests and parasites. Unlike most Stanford students, and indeed most scientists, I've witnessed the suffocating deaths of countless trees brought about by what we can only conclude is global climate change. My mother, Constance Davis, is a biologist. Perhaps you've heard of her? I'm a product of both of them, and that's where my interest in my thesis topic comes from. 2. Yes, I plan to go to Yunnan. I don't need outside funding. My family will provide it. I'll take my first trip over spring break, which corresponds to Yunnan's tea-picking season. I agree that joining another study would be opportune. Tufts Institute of the Environment, in cooperation with the Ethnobiology Department of the Chinese Ministry of Education and sponsored by the National Science Foundation, is currently doing a multidisciplinary study. The team includes a chemical ecologist, cultural anthropologist, soil and crop scientist, agricultural economist, and others, on the effects of extreme climate events on terrace tea and wild tea crop yields in Yunnan. I've been in contact with the study's leader, Dr. Joan Berry, and she's agreed to my participation in the project, much of which I can do on my laptop in my dorm room and by analyzing tea samples in the lab here on campus. The current plan is for me to travel in the tea mountains for a week by myself to enlist informants and gather tea samples for my project. Then I'll join the Tufts team for the second week. Dr. Berry says she looks forward to seeing the results of my research. 3. Yes, I see this as a multi-year study which I hope to pursue, whether I'm accepted into Stanford's graduate program or I go to one of the East Coast universities already recruiting me. For now, though, I'd like to begin my research in the way I outlined in my earlier email. 4. As for your question about the health benefits of tea, let me just say that there are currently 200 studies being undertaken around the world addressing this topic. Believe me, I'm going into this with my eyes wide open and with all the skepticism and rigor Western science should bring to the table. 5.1. The fact that I asked you to be my advisor has nothing to do with your race. I thought and continue to believe that your work on the effects of air particulates on children living in the Yangtze Delta was a good match. 2. I appreciate your suggestion that I incorporate Chinese poetry and philosophy into my thesis. In fact, I've already done a little research and think it might be more inclusive and provocative to include some popular American thoughts about tea as well. For example, a recent issue of Bon Appetit devoted space, I believe for the first time, to tea. In it, American culinary pioneer Alice Waters credited Poor for helping to lower her cholesterol by 100 points and get her off coffee. It's not poetry, obviously, but if someone like Alice Waters says something like that so publicly, especially if it's in a food magazine and not a scientific journal, won't that drive interest in tea in general and Poor in particular? And won't that in turn make the issue of the effects of climate change on tea trees even more pressing? In closing, I need to address your concerns about my traveling companion. While no one can fully understand another person's motives, I doubt he has any romantic interest in me. I assume that's what you were suggesting. If not, I'm hugely embarrassed. He's a tea nerd. I hadn't known such a thing existed, but it does. I feel lucky to have connected with an expert in the field who can address so many of your logistical concerns. I hope you will still consider being my advisor. Sincerely, Haley Davis.
Dear Haley, of course I know your mother. Everyone in our field knows your mother for the quality and importance of her work. We've been attempting to recruit her for our biology department for years. She's always said she didn't want to uproot her family. I should have put two and two together. It's my own ignorance that didn't allow me to match your name and your talents to her face. I apologize. I apologize as well for my part in the other misunderstanding. I will gladly be your advisor. Come to my office hours next Tuesday for further discussion. Among other things, I'd like to know, given your last email, if you'll be looking at tea in general or just this Poor that you mentioned. I see some real benefits in narrowing from a panoramic and encyclopedic view to going in-depth on one varietal. Until Tuesday, Professor Annabeth Ho.
Dear Professor Ho, yay! My mother will be so excited when I tell her. I am very much looking forward to working with you, Haley.
As uncontrollable as the wind. Are you stalking me? I ask. No matter where I go, there you are.
Ah, Tina!
Mr. Huang gives me an ingratiating smile.
Maybe we're meant to know each other. Have you ever thought about that?
No.
I'll call you by your American name, he says. When will you start calling me by mine? John.
Never. We're on the terrace of the tea house in the Chinese Scholar's Garden at the Huntington Library. It's early February, and we're here to celebrate the forthcoming Year of the Monkey and to help raise funds for the final phase of the Chinese Garden. Heaters warm the terrace. Chinese lanterns hanging in trees along the lakeside cast a ruby glow. Champagne and appetizers are passed. Anyone who's anyone in the Chinese-American community in Los Angeles is here. East-West Bank's Dominic Inn and his wife, Panda Express's Peggy and Andrew Chern, and the toy mogul Wu Brothers. Some speak in Mandarin, but most use English so as not to be rude to the old-money Pasadena couples who've been supporting the Huntington for decades. Is Xianrong enjoying his new home? I inquire, trying to be polite. Jin's company sold Mr. Huang and his son houses, mansions really, in San Marino and Pasadena, respectively. He shrugs.
It's good to have him close by. The economy is slowing in China. We can make more money with my cranes here. You'll be seeing us much more now.
I smile, but he's known me so long that he has to realize it's not sincere.
I'll be going to the T-Mount.